Welcome everybody back to the show. It's December 21st, 2013, and this is Pop Culture Network Radio. Is the music too loud? Is it coming through too loud? Who cares? Ladies and gentlemen, today on the show, we're going to be talking about a number of different things, including what's possibly the toy of the year. That's right. We're talking toy of the year toys. We're also going to talk about the best comic I've read in a long time from one of the major publishers, came out this week. It's Amazing Spider-Man 700.5, and you're going to think, a .5, that is so stupid, and it is, but it's a great comic, and ignore points 1 through 4, we'll talk about that coming up. I don't know if we really have much other news or what. Oh, that's right. I promised everybody we'd talk about the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. We're going to talk about the complete series of Freddy Krueger films today. So, with all of that in the hopper for today's show, it's an action-packed one, but before we get started, we have to talk a little bit about this podcast. I don't know if we're going to do one next week, just because the holidays, yes, Christmas and all of New Year's and everybody in town and all that kind of stuff. I'm not sure if I'm doing one next week. If I do, it probably will not be on Friday or Saturday next week. It'll just be whenever we can do it. And that may very well may be Christmas night. I'm not sure. As far as going forward in 2014, is this still going to be a weekend show? I'm not sure. A couple months ago when I started doing this show, there was nothing going on Fridays, and I thought Friday afternoon is a perfect time to record a show because there's absolutely nothing else going on. I don't have to worry about it. And then, of course, as the holidays came, everything started going on Thursday nights and Friday nights. And days just got so crowded with so much stuff going on. And, you know, people understand that's the holidays. There was no show last week. Part of it was the weather had, you know, kind of messed everything up. Plans for everything had to change because the weather had gotten so bad outside. You know, it was rainy ice. We had snow, too. But there was ice that fell first, and then the snow came. And so when I was driving to work, actually, last Saturday morning, I was going to come in early, do the podcast, and I got to the end of my block, and I, pressed the brakes to stop at the stoplight there, and my truck just decided it wanted to do a 180 right out in the middle of the intersection. That was a good time. It took me about half an hour to drive to work, which is normally about a 7-minute drive. That's how bad everything was last week, and so just fell behind, didn't have a chance to get to the show. And, you know, so much stuff going on with the holidays, everybody around. This week, of course, a lot of stuff going on. Yesterday, I was doing some of the last-minute Christmas shopping. I'm done now. I'm done shopping. Everybody's covered. If I haven't gotten you a gift yet for Christmas, you ain't getting one. Sorry about that. But, you know, I went out yesterday, finished all my Christmas shopping, so all of that's done. And then this morning, I was like, I'm going to get up early. I'm going to come into the store, do the podcast, and of course, what happens? It starts raining ice again. And outside right now, everything is just one sheet of ice. Last week, we didn't have a whole lot of business in the store on Saturday because there was nobody out driving because the weather was terrible, and I have a feeling it might be the same, going on today here at the store. But this is our last week of business in this location before we move to the new store. And then we get the new store set up, we can have the studio set up there, and we'll have a much easier time recording video and audio, getting all of this stuff together and out there. So, looking forward to taking care of all of that. But, different things to talk about today. And I guess, I don't know, where should we start? We will start with comics. And this isn't going to take very long. This is just going to be short, but what I wanted to talk about this week was just a comic book that came out this week that took me by surprise. And I really wasn't expecting much out of it. And I think that's usually how you find like the best stuff, the stuff that, you know, really kind of reaches for. You can have a hotly anticipated title that comes out and you read it and you're like, oh yeah, that's pretty good. But, you know, I mean, you were expecting it to be good, so it just doesn't resonate the same way. But I think for me, when I go into reading something and I'm not expecting something great out of it, I'm just expecting it to be what it is and, you know, nothing particularly more than that, I'm blown away when it's actually very good. And that, to me, makes a whole lot more, you know, it makes more of an impact on me because I wasn't expecting anything special and I found something special in it. And for me, that is Amazing Spider-Man 700.5. Now, 1.4, or 0.1 through 0.4 were not great. They were okay, but nothing really stuck out as like, wow, you need to read that. So, you know, I read through them and I wouldn't say I felt like I wasted my money, but they just, they were just there. They didn't really need to be made. They were old Peter Parker stories. They were just trying to have, kind of like this throwback in December to Peter, the days of Peter Parker. So, you know, they just had some Peter Parker Spider-Man stories. So whatever. 700.5, last one that came out, and honestly, I wasn't sure if I was even going to read it, because 1 through 4 just, you know, didn't really do much for me, but I decided, why not? And so here is the solicitation for it. Peter Parker and Johnny Storm must stop an apocalyptic future by fighting the Fantastic Four? So, of course. It doesn't sound, it sounds like every other, you know, sci-fi 70s Spider-Man type story. What happens is Johnny Storm flies into Peter Parker's apartment, and he's got this bag. And the thing from the future has given him this bag, and it's like the Calvin device or something they call it. And Thing tells, future Thing tells Johnny Storm, you've got to keep this from Reed. If Reed Richards gets his hands on this, he will cause the end of the world. So, you know, so Johnny Storm is like kind of freaking out a little bit. Like, I have to take this device. I have to, you know, get it away from Reed. I have to, you know, go hide it, whatever. And he wants Spider-Man to help him keep it away from the Fantastic Four. So, of course, Reed Richards, finding out about this, goes, the Calvin device could end the universe. How? I've got to take a look at this thing. How does this thing work? How is this going to cause the end of the universe? I want to see this. Like, he doesn't want to end the world, but he's just so obsessed with the idea that this thing could cause it that he wants to know how it works and why it could happen and that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, basically playing right along into this story. And I don't want to give away because the resolution of this story is the key to why it's so good. Reading like the first three-fourths of the story, it's kind of like watching a Japanese wrestling match where you're going to, you know, the match goes 15 minutes and you watch the first 10 and you're like, well, why is this match of the year? Who cares? And then you watch the last 5 minutes and it's like, oh, okay, that's why. It's the same thing with this issue. You're going to read the first three-fourths of the story and you're just going to go, I don't really, like, whatever. Like, why is this a big deal? And then when you read that ending, and then there's like a tiny epilogue at the end, then everything falls into place. And it is just so good. Now, I'm a big fan of the current Superior Spider-Man. I love Otto Octavius as Peter Parker, as Spider-Man. I love everything about that storyline. So, you know, I kind of didn't really want to like these because they are the old school of Peter Parker. And so many people were like, oh, this means Peter Parker is coming back. And I'm like, I hope not, because I love Superior. But this is fantastic, and you got to read it. Now, there's a backup story. A young child risks his life to save Spider-Man's in an emotional What Would Spider-Man Do? And it's okay. You can kind of feel the ending, you know, telegraphing itself in there. It's one of those things, probably the current comic book reader, only been reading for, you know, 2 to 5 years maybe. And so for them, it's like, oh, that's kind of a touching story. Everyone else, you've read the story before. Nothing too spectacular about that backup. But that first one with the Fantastic Four is great. So I'm going to say, everybody, you need to keep your eyes on that. All right, let's see. Next up, what are we going to talk about? Toy of the Year! Toy of the Year. I started a thread on the forums because there was a discussion that started to evolve in one of the other threads about what toy was Toy of the Year. Is there anything that really, you know, you've got Metroplex, Titan Metroplex, and you had Castle Grayskull, and there's a lot of people online kind of fighting back and forth over which ones, you know, blah, 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 whatever. So, started a poll on the website, and I will say, before we start this, I listed 6 different toys. And out of these 6, I said, please choose one. And if the toy that you think should be toy of the year isn't on this list, then, you know, feel free to add it in the comments at the bottom, but still pick one from this list. You know, that's where I went with that. And we're going to, you know, talk about these different figures a little bit, these different toys. And I'm going to make my determination on what the toy of the year is. And it's going to anger some people. Some people are going to get mad, and they're going to say, well, that's not what... Obviously, this toy should have been... Hey, it's my show. And if you don't like it, then start your own podcast. That's all I can say. So anyway, let's talk about some of these different toys. When I started the poll, by the way, and I meant to put Metroplex, and I typed Fortress Maximus. I'd been reading one of the IDW comics, and Fortress Maximus was in it, and so I typed Fortress Maximus thinking Metroplex. I know, how could you ever confuse the two? My mistake. Sorry about that. So anyway, if you go and look at the thread, it's Big Guns, which toy topped them all, on the Join the Forums, the official forums of the Pop Culture Network. It does say Fortress Maximus. It's supposed to say Metroplex. Whatever. All right. Here are the ones that I listed as the original six. Castle Grayskull, obviously. Fortress Maximus, which is supposed to be Metroplex. San Diego Comic-Con Masterpiece Soundwave. 20th Anniversary Mighty Morphin Power Rangers Legacy Megazord. Ghostbusters Ecto Goggles. And the Deadpool Core San Diego Comic-Con Taco Set. Now, these are all toys which I felt could work as Toy of the Year. Like, any one of these you could pick and say, that was the number one. And an argument could be made, really, for any of them. And the argument could be made against any of them. But those, I felt, kind of... The spectrum and of boys' toys, yes, I understand. There's... Equestria Girls, there's the Funko My Little Ponies. I'm not even, you know, you can have, start your own podcast on those. You know, more power to you if you want to cover those. Not covering those here. Talking boy toys. And so, looking at these, I mean, first of all, you can kind of go through the Ghostbusters Ecto Goggles. You can make the argument that it's a prop replica, not a toy, per se. So you can kind of make the argument that that one doesn't really fit there. I know it was a big deal for a lot of people. A lot of people really liked it. It was one of those big ticket items they were really waiting for. A lot of people have wanted those since they were in the fifth grade. And, you know, the other toys were coming out in the real Ghostbusters line. And they wanted those goggles. And now that they have real movie prop replicas, you know, that was the one for them. You can make that argument. For me, though, you know, not Toy of the Year. The Deadpool Core San Diego Comic-Con Taco Set. Now, for those of you that don't remember this, this set looked like a taco delivery truck. And when you open the taco delivery truck, there were the four figure packs inside, and each one came in a taco shell. And you folded open the taco shell, and in there, like, printed inside the taco shell, they had actually printed meat and tomatoes and whatever, and there on a little blister was Deadpool, Lady Deadpool... was it Kidpool? And then there was a pack with like Headpool and the dog, I think, Dogpool, whatever. Anyway, that set, it was a fun set. The figures themselves were nothing too incredible. They were just, you know, stuff from basically the Marvel Universe line, from that line of sculpts. It came in a neat presentation. It was a great pack. It was a brilliant idea. I kind of wish that was one of those things that wasn't so hard to get, because that's something that I would buy, but not at a premium at a con price, you know? So, I mean, it was a neat pack, but I mean, Toy of the Year, there was nothing really special about the toys. It's more about the packaging and the marketing of it. So anyway, not Toy of the Year for me. 20th Anniversary Mighty Morphin Power Rangers Legacy Megazord. Now, I know this hit for a lot of people. They love Power Rangers. The idea of the mechs, you know, the giant Zords fighting is the big thing for them. They love it. Being able to get a high-quality, modern version of a toy that they probably got when they were in junior high, maybe high school, when the original series was on, it's kind of a big deal to get that back. It's a nice-looking figure. I don't know. I heard some complaints from people. They wanted little figures to go with it. It's not really in scale with some of the other stuff. So, I mean, you can, again, there's, you know, arguments, criticisms to make on all the, for me, I'm just going to have to leave it at that before I make anyone angry. So let's move on. Let's talk about the Metroplex. Metroplex, finally got my hands on one not too long ago. It's a great toy. The price has come down. It was originally $130. Now you can find it for like $80 if you've got a local Costco. Toys R Us dropped the price on it, had sales on it. So it's, you know, cheaper. It's nice. I mean, it is a really nice toy. I think in robot mode, it looks incredible. When it's in city mode, it actually looks really nice. There's a lot of details in there that I didn't expect. The way that they, you know, added some of the guns. And once you put the stickers on, it makes a difference. But that's kind of one of the downfalls of it, is that it has 100 stickers that you have to, I mean, literally. It'll say, like, that there's 98 of them, but some of them are more than one. It's like all of the exhaust ports on his back. There's like six of them, and that counts as one sticker, even though it's six different stickers, you know, stuff like that. There's just a ton of stickers, or decals, however you want to pronounce it. And a lot of them are very small, and I had to get out tweezers and a toothpick to try to get them on there, because I have just, you know, gigantic fingers. And so it's a pain to put the labels on. Robot mode looks incredible. It's very well articulated. The city mode is really great. They thought through a lot of really neat stuff about it. I love how the head actually becomes a gun turret. You make him look down, his antenna becomes guns, and there's a little flip-up display, you know, targeting sight and handles you can have a little guy holding on to. They thought it out really well. My one problem, though, is the vehicle mode. Since it is technically a triple changer, it's a vehicle mode, city mode, and robot mode. The vehicle mode just doesn't really do anything for me. It's supposed to be some kind of futuristic aircraft carrier type device, but it just doesn't work. It just doesn't look that special, and there's just lots of kibble once you do that. I mean, the hands are just kind of hanging out in the back, you know? I mean, there's no real place to put them. And I find that Metroplex is kind of falling into that same trap that Hasbro has been doing a lot with Transformers, where they have a lot of alt modes and extra stuff that they can do in the way accessories work and things pop out and how you can pop something off and put it on somewhere else and it does something different. But they don't give that to you in the instructions. You just have to kind of play with it and figure out it does that, which is fun on the one hand because you're exploring and experimenting and, you know, discovering something new with your toy, and that's great. But at the same time, it's kind of annoying. You're like, well, what's this piece? Why is this? Oh, I can take this off and move it here, and now it works a different way. I see. But you kind of wish they just told you that to begin with. Let's talk about Castle Grayskull. For most people, they are going to say that this is their toy of the year. 2013 Masters of the Universe Classics Castle Grayskull. It is an awesome looking toy. It's a playset. It's a carrying case. I mean, the original one was a carrying case. This one's not really so much, but you can still throw a couple figures in there when you close it up, I guess, if you want to do that. But, it's got some neat stuff. It's got, you know, the jail in there. You can drop the guy through the trap door, have him in the jail. You've got, floor piece that, you know, pops out and you can put in there to help kind of solidify its look as a playset. It's got extra stuff on the backside of it where you can have a character stand around. It's really got some nice detail and nice effects to it. It's a great toy, but it is $250 if you bought it in advance, $280, I think, if you buy it now. And for me, when I look at it, it's not worth that. Now, I know a lot of people are going to go, oh my God, what? Because this is the greatest toy they've ever seen in the history of their life. And you could put $500 on it and they'd buy it at $500. It doesn't make any difference to them. Get your own podcast. As far as my show, the cost of that for $250, it is not a $250 toy. That is a $150 toy. At $150, I would put that as Toy of the Year. I cannot do it at $250 because the price, to me, does make a difference on the value of the toy. If everything was free and they were just handing them out to everybody, then yes, Castle Grayskull would be Toy of the Year, but not at that price. Mattel just, they really wanted to see it happen. They had to fight very hard to get the pre-orders, to get it out there, which did affect the price. The Masters of the Universe Classics line is struggling. It's having a hard time finding the audience. Part of that's Digital River. Part of that's, some of the characters that they've gone with over the years. Part of that is the whole subscription model that they've based the whole thing on to begin with. But I can't look at that thing and say it's worth $250. I know some of you will. Some of you are going to say that. But, I mean, when you're looking at, that's comparable to, like, a laptop or a premium tablet. That's where you're looking at $250, $270. And to me, Castle Grayskull just doesn't match that. Like I said, if it was $150, hands down, it would be Toy of the Year. But not at $250. That's just, to me, that the price of the item does make a difference on the overall value of the item. And value being, both in terms of money and in terms of just, aesthetics and playability and everything else. Price does make a difference. I know a lot of people are going to disagree with that. Feel free. Tweet it. Post it on the message board. Comment on YouTube. But that's what it comes down to for me. So it is not Toy of the Year. So, if I didn't pick Deadpool, I didn't pick Ghostbusters, I didn't pick the Megazord, I didn't pick Metroplex, not Grayskull, what did I pick as Toy of the Year? Let's go through some of the other things. We did have someone on the board known as the Skull. He collects hot toys. And for him, he said the Toy of the Year is the DX-13 battle-damaged T-800 Terminator. And it's from Hot Toys. When you look at Hot Toys, Hot Toys look like very much like the character that they are representing. Unlike a Marvel action figure, a DC action figure, some sort of movie tie-in figure, these look eerily real. The people who sculpt these have an eye for detail that's unmatched in the toy industry. The battle damage T-800, the way they've put the accessories on him, the way they've, the blood, what they use for the blood and the skin tone looks real. This is one of those things where you go to like a wax museum, and you look at the people in the wax museum and you're like, kinda, I guess, looks like them, but not really. If the wax museum was full of hot toys, then people would be like, oh my gosh, they nailed it. Photos, a lot of times, of hot toys look like photos of the actors that they are representing. And that is no easy feat. So it is a phenomenal, phenomenal toy. But here's my complaint, and it goes back to the same complaint that I had with Castle Grayskull. Sideshow Collectibles, T-800 Battle Damaged. $304.99. He's cool, but $300 cool? I can't bite. I cannot bite on that. Because it's like saying a life-size Stormtrooper outfit. Awesome. If you made a life-size Stormtrooper action figure that was 6.5 feet tall and had every detail, made every sound, you just couldn't take off the helmet because then it would kind of be creepy. You're just buying a mannequin. But instead, it's just like this giant suit that you can put on display. And that could be Toy of the Year. Sure. It's $5,000. But hey, if that's the metric we're using, then the greatest toy of this generation is the Tron Light Cycle. It's $55,000. You can order it. It's street legal. It looks exactly like the Light Cycle from Tron Legacy, but it's $55,000. So that's not Toy of the Year. You know what I mean? That's just kind of the same problem I have with Hot Toys. When I look at Hot Toys, they are some of the most beautiful, well-done toys. I would love to have any of them, really. But at that price, I can't bite. I can't do it. That just doesn't work for me. So, but still very pretty. Very pretty. I'll give you that. Fortress Maximus. Is there a Fortress Maximus this year? Honestly, I don't know. I couldn't say that. I am going to say that for my pick, Toy of the Year is Masterpiece Soundwave San Diego Comic-Con 2013. That, to me, it was the right toy, the right price point. It was $130, I think it was, when it originally was announced. You could find certain deals online and whatnot if you got it. But you got the Masterpiece Soundwave, and you also got the 5 cassettes that went with him. And that, to me, the Masterpiece Soundwave as it is a very nice figure. If it was just the figure or just the figure in Laserbeak, which came out before, to me, that wouldn't be Toy of the Year. But the fact that they did it with all 5 of the cassettes, and you've got the missiles, and you got the attachments for the, the data port add-on, and you got the missiles for the cassettes. You know, you got the and some of the cassettes, I hadn't seen Ravage as a Masterpiece type cassette, and they've now figured out how to make that cassette fold out, and his little rockets that you used to have to stick on the side of him are built in. Like, they are part of how it comes together. Rumble and Frenzy have the attachments for their arm things that slam, 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 slam. And when you fold up Soundwave, you can actually work those into the transformation. So when Soundwave is fully transformed, you can fully transform him, fully transform all the cassettes into their cassette shapes, and everything's accounted for. Everything has a spot. Everything, some of it may look a little weird. Like, for instance, there's a data port on the side of Soundwave. You can take 2 of the Rumble, Ravage, Frenzy, or no, not Ravage, Frenzy, yeah. Frenzy and Rumble's Earthquake things, and you can take them, and they attach into this little backpack thing, which attaches to a data port thing, and it becomes like a thumb drive that's plugged into the side of this futuristic cassette deck. Like, it's going to stream MP3s off of the thumb drive. Like, it has a spot where it works. Excuse me. It may not be the most organic way to bundle them together, but it works, So at least they thought it through. They at least thought, let's do something with this, and they found a way to make something with it, and it works, and it's packaged, and it's part of the deal. The only problem is when you unpack everything and you transform them all into robots, you do have the cassette cases, which are just kind of left over, but technically you can use those cassette cases to make Energon cubes. It's a kind of a stretch putting that together, but everything about the Masterpiece Soundwave, from the box it came in to the plastic shell that it sits in inside the box, to the way it transforms, to the accessories it came with, to the way all the accessories fit together, everything about that says Toy of the Year to me. And some people are going to complain that this Soundwave is basically the same Masterpiece Soundwave from before, that they just made some subtle tweaks in, and then packaged with all this other stuff. But to me, that does it. That makes the difference. That sends it over the top. They took something and perfected it. I don't know of any better way that you could do Masterpiece Soundwave, except maybe if you figured out an easier way to handle the transformation. And that is kind of one of the problems with it. And I can see that as being an argument. For all these people that say, well, it should be Castle Grayskull, it shouldn't be Soundwave, he's using old parts that they brought back together, I can understand your argument. If that's your argument, fine. If you think Castle Grayskull was Toy of the Year, I'm happy for you. Knock yourself out. I'm not here to start a fight. I'm not here to tell you you're stupid. I'm not here to tell you to go jump off a bridge. I'll tell you start your own podcast, do your own show if you want to do that. But, I mean, as far as it comes down, we all have personal opinions. We all have our own personal beliefs of what toy is going to be the best. And for me, it's Masterpiece Soundwave. That is just the Toy of the Year. And there are some great reasons for it being Toy of the Year. And so that's where my argument is. If you say it's Castle Grayskull, great for you. But for me, as far as Pop Culture Network, the radio is concerned, Pop Culture Network Radio says Masterpiece Soundwave from San Diego Comic-Con is Toy of the Year for 2013. I am going to pause the show real quick, get a drink of water, and then when we come back, which will be simultaneous for you, I don't even know why I'm telling you this, we are going to talk about Nightmare on Elm Street, the entire franchise. So, we'll be right back. And we're back. So, Nightmare on Elm Street. Nightmare on Elm Street is a franchise basically built around the idea that you can die in your dream, which causes you to die in real life. There is a character named Freddy Krueger, who is a child murderer, who is killed by a bunch of vigilante parents. He is burned alive in the boiler room at the school where he worked. And his ghost basically invades the dreams of the children of these parents. He kills them in their dreams so that they die in real life. And their children taken away from the parents. The story originally... Here's the thing. Sometimes when you hear about Nightmare on Elm Street, they'll say it's based on a true story. And that's not exactly true. It's based on a true story, like the movie The Strangers was based on a true story, or Texas Chainsaw Massacre was based on a true story, which is to say, not really. There were things happening that kind of inspired the idea behind it, but not like there's anything that you could actually tie into as a plot device. Ed Gein was not... He was closer to Psycho than he was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but even Psycho, it's still not based on a true story. By that same rationale, The Strangers is not based on a true story. Nightmare on Elm Street is not based on a true story. But it's based on the idea that there were these Cambodian refugees that came to the United States. And after witnessing some of the atrocities that they saw over there at the hands of the communists, they were having horrible nightmares. And basically, they were having heart palpitations, arrhythmia, whatever. While they were sleeping, having these nightmares, their heart rate, got so out of whack that they died. Some guys, the nightmares were haunting them so bad, one guy was trying not to sleep, and he was, trying to stay awake for days on end. It was making him delirious, and in a fit of delirium, he tried to cut off his own eyelids to keep himself awake, Not that there was somebody hunting them, or they all saw the same person in their dreams, they had a dream where they died, so they died in real life, because, how would you know? Get the Ouija board out and talk to them. But that's kind of where it comes from, that idea that it's based on a true story, It's not, but that's kind of where the inspiration came from. And originally, Freddy Krueger was seen more of like a child molester. He was like a rapist and murderer. And then it kind of became more like he just killed him. He would kind of freak him out and he might do some suggestive phrases or poses, but for the most part, it was really more about just he was a child murderer. And I don't know if that's because the sexual angle just kind of freaked people out too much. That's hitting a little too close to home, or maybe they just, that's too exploitive. I don't know how you ever want to say that. But anyway, so the movies, just became your straight slasher fare of the 80s and early 90s. And for people like me growing up, it is the, adjusted for inflation, it's the second highest grossing horror franchise of all time, if you adjust for inflation. Friday the 13th is first, but Nightmare on Elm Street is second. They've done a whole slew of movies, which we will talk our way through, as well as Nightmare on Elm Street, the series. They had some tween books that came out for a while. They had a bunch of comics and whatever else. But we won't worry so much about Freddy's nightmares and some of the comics and stuff, but we will talk about the movies. And there are 9 movies altogether in the franchise, which may be one reason why it lags behind Friday the 13th. I think when you adjust for inflation, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies do better than Friday the 13th per movie. But I think there are more movies in Friday the 13th, and so therefore it's higher grossing as far as that goes. But the movies here, let's see. We start with Nightmare on Elm Street. the original, came out in 1984, directed by Wes Craven, written by Wes Craven. And it tells the story of Nancy. Nancy Thompson is the daughter of the sheriff. The sheriff is part of the family that hunted down Freddy Krueger and killed him. This was back when Nancy was very young. So, of course, she doesn't really remember anything that happened. But basically, when Freddy Krueger was murdered by the parents, his spirit somehow stuck around and waited for Nancy to start going through puberty. So she'd be confused, she'd be in a weird place, whatever. And it somehow allowed him to get into her dreams and kind of, you know, take over and affect her mind. And that kind of the strength that he found in getting into those nightmares allowed him to kind of power himself and to come back and start killing off the teenagers again. Which, I mean, if you think about it, it's kind of a silly story in as far as, you know, he couldn't go after children after he was murdered. He had to wait for those children to become older teenagers. So don't think about the logic of it. For those of you paying real close attention, you'll probably notice that the sound of my voice has changed a little bit here. We just had to pause the show and move to a new location because we've time shifted about 10 hours forward. The work day got away from me, had to open the store, did all day working in the store today, and now I'm back home. So now it's nighttime. The first part of that show was in the morning. Now it's evening. Sorry to break the flow of the show there, but just wanted to throw that out there so you knew what was going on. Now, going back to Nightmare on Elm Street, there are a couple things that I want to point out about it. First of all, the hat that Freddy wears is not the traditional type fedora that he wears later on in the series that comes like an iconic piece. It's almost like the hat that Ducky wears in 16 Candles. It's a different type of hat. I don't even know. I'm not a haberdasher. Run a haberdashery. Whatever you'd say that. I'm not a person who knows a lot about hats. So I'm not sure what exactly type of hat it is. Maybe it is a version of a fedora. But later on it had more of that classic, iconic fedora look. But in the early films it doesn't. Second of all, the makeup in the first film was different. They streamlined it, made it easier as the series went on, so it didn't take as long in the makeup chair. But in that first movie, they actually created the burn scar makeup for Freddy Krueger in two different parts, basically, two different layers, I guess you could say. The first layer was the muscle underneath. And so he had basically that look of the strings of the muscle tissue. And then they put a second layer on top, which was the burned skin kind of stretched, you know, kind of peeling and ripping apart in places. And that's what gave Freddy Krueger his iconic look. And then as the series progressed, they just simplified the makeup more and more and more. So it was easier to put on and take off. And so you can see as the series goes, it just kind of really becomes like these splotches on his face. That's supposed to have that same look. But in the first movie, and kind of in the second movie, but really in that first movie, it does really have that kind of ripped up, meaty look to it. And I always thought it just looked so much better in that first one, but it took hours in the makeup chair, which is probably a good reason in the long run that they streamlined it and cut it back a little bit. The movie itself, overall, considering the budget that they had, they really kept a lot of the special effects in line with what they could do. There's just one scene where Freddy is walking down this alley and he stretches out his arms and he has these giant fake arms as he's reaching across the entire alleyway. And that, to me, is the only time that really stands out in my mind where the effects break down and the movie just doesn't work. Like, I kind of want them to cut that scene out, you know? If I was in the editing room, I'd just go, might need to rework that a little bit. But otherwise, I think it does a really good job. And it does sufficiently have a creep factor to it that I think is missing in a lot of the other movies. It just has that feel to it, like it's dirty and it's dingy and very realistic. And that's something that happens a lot of times when movies have no budget, because they just have to find a location that already exists and kind of move into it and use that to make their movie. Whereas later on, they would actually build sound stages and have these giant sets and whatever. And then it just, it doesn't look as real. It does look more fake, I guess. It's not real, so there you go. I guess the only other part that I would kind of, I would kind of take issue with is the, how she supposedly gets rid of Freddy. She turns her back on him and takes away the power he has over her. And so he lunges at her and he just turns into like a starry mist and disappears. And that also never really worked for me. I mean, in the long run, with the added ending where they had the Freddy convertible, you know, take them all away into a nightmare, it kind of works in the idea that it didn't work, and so Freddy's still out there. But in the sense of that was supposed to be the big resolve to make Freddy go away, it just feels kind of silly. And it just doesn't, for as visceral as it became this fight with Nancy and Freddy in the real world, and she's actually, you know, punching them and hitting them and, you know, using sledgehammers and, you know, whatever to try to kill him. The idea of just turning and taking away his power doesn't work. And it doesn't work in that sense that you've brought him into the real world. Like, you've taken him out of the dream and made him real. So therefore, you should be able to, or you should have to kill him in a real way, not in that magical way. One other neat thing, just as a little side note piece of trivia, when Nancy goes to the sleep clinic and is being checked by the doctor there is the guy who did the voice of Roger Rabbit from Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So there you go. Next time you're doing 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, see if that helps you in any way. I don't know if it actually does. All right. So that's going to do it for part one. Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, came out 1 year later, 1985. Wes Craven stepped away from the franchise. You know, he really didn't see any reason to come back and revisit it to do a number two. So brought in a new writer, a new director. And where the first movie is the story of Nancy, you had a strong female protagonist. Her boyfriend, played by Johnny Depp, is very, well, I mean, he's a, I don't know, you want to call him a wussy? I don't know what the right term is. He's a, not a strong male character. So definitely had a lot of people said one of the things that made it stand out was it had a feminine feel to it. When they did the second movie, they wanted a male protagonist, but it also had a very, I don't know if feminine feel is the right word for it, but it was kind of the, having a male protagonist, you would think it would have more of that kind of male bravado feel to it, and this one really doesn't. It's a boy, Jesse, who's moved into the Thompson house. He is in Nancy's old room, and somehow Freddy is sneaking into his dreams and into his subconscious and is manifesting himself through Jesse and kind of taking over Jesse's body in order to come back into the real world and kill people again. And the story is really like a big metaphor for kind of coming of age and kind of growing into your sexuality and kind of figuring out who you are. And there were, the writer of this, David Chaskin, I believe is how you pronounce it, he says that there were supposed to be a lot of subtle things about the insecurity of your sexuality and how you don't really understand where you fit in the world. But instead, it just kind of became this big gay movie. And it wasn't meant to be, but it's kind of been accepted by that community. There's a lot of jokes. There's a lot of dialogue that when you don't have this idea of these homosexual overtones, they're just people talking. But then once you insert that idea of him, you know, trying to discover if he's straight or gay or whatever, that it really takes on a whole new meaning. The way he goes to his friend to watch over him when he's, you know, falling asleep. You know, he wants to stay in his bedroom, you know, to have his friend, you know, watch him in case anything weird happens to him. And the gym teacher in the movie, he's actually in an S&M bar. Jesse tries to, you know, sneak in, whatever, and the gym teacher finds him. He, of course, gets slaughtered. But there's a lot of stuff where, in the dream sequence where he's killed, he's trapped in the showers. There are towels, you know, snapping him in the bare butt cheeks and all this kind of stuff. So it really did kind of take on these homosexual overtones that it really wasn't supposed to have. And so if people tell you that that's the point of it, if someone tells you, like, that's the reason why that's in the movie, it's not. It's just kind of one of those things that after the whole thing came together, everybody kind of looked at the complete package and went, oh, huh. And, you know, what can you do about it once it's done? So that's what that was. And it's okay. It's not really... It doesn't live up to the original. It doesn't expand on the original. It doesn't really bring much new to it. And it doesn't fit. If you look at the entire series, the entire franchise, and the storyline, it really has nothing to do with the others except for the fact that Freddy's in it. So, overall, it's one of my least favorite in the series just because it doesn't really seem to fit with everything else going on. Let's see. Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, came out in 1987, directed by Chuck Russell. Wes Craven came back to help write this one. He worked with Frank Darabont, who, if you remember, was the showrunner on The Walking Dead for the first two seasons, or first season and a half, whatever. Also, Chuck Russell and Bruce Wagner worked on that one. And this is when Freddy hit the big time. Like, this is the movie when the slasher craze was taking off. Freddy was very huge. Same time, Jason was huge. Texas Chainsaw Massacre was kind of getting re-examined, and I think Part 2 came out around this time. And, you know, you were having all these straight-to-video. This was, like, part of the boom of straight-to-video, and this was about the time that someone like me, as a kid, 1987, I started sixth grade. When I was in sixth grade, my sister was in ninth grade. Because she was in high school, my parents would let her and her friends watch horror movies, which I wasn't supposed to do. But because I'm a sneaky little SOB, I used to sneak down and watch the horror movies that she and her friends were watching. So kind of around this time period is when I started getting into all the Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween and all that kind of stuff. So That VHS boom, this kind of quickening, if you will, of all the slasher characters and all that kind of stuff, shot, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street into the stratosphere. And with Dream Warriors, the idea is that Nancy Thompson comes back to Springwood. That she, you know, was never killed, whatever, but she went to college. She learned about dreams, and she became a therapist or a psychoanalyst or psychologist or whatever. And she's come back to Springwood to try to help the kids because she understands what's going on. She really knows what's happening. And they put her into a treatment center, mental ward for teenagers, basically. She is working with the doctors there, trying to figure out, you know, how to stop the dreams from happening, how to defeat Freddy, and save these kids. A couple notes here. One, Lawrence Fishburne, the guy from The Matrix, probably a little movie some of you have seen, he makes an appearance in here as an orderly. That was kind of neat. I forget about that sometimes. I go to put it in. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's him. And then the other kind of interesting side note is that one of the actresses in this movie, Jennifer Rubin, actually went on to make another movie called Bad Dreams. And Bad Dreams, as you can imagine, is about a girl having nightmares. And these nightmares are basically, she escaped as a young girl from a cult called Unity Fields. And she's having these nightmares where she's remembering the cult leader kind of coming back and trying to kill her. And she's institutionalized as they try to work out her psychosis. And she meets a gang of other young people there. And there's a lot of similarities between Bad Dreams and Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3. And I don't know if there's any sort of link between the two other than somebody was working on another slasher movie and Nightmare on Elm Street was big and she was in it, so she got hired and it got rushed into production. Maybe some people, you know, like, oh, this sounds a lot like this script that we have sitting here that we haven't done anything with. And so they hired her to come in. I don't know necessarily that it was one of those type of, like, Asylum-type movies, one of those movies trying to cash in on it. But it is very similar, but I really like it. Bad Dreams is one of those movies every, I don't know, 2 or 3 years maybe, I try to hunt it down and watch it again. I really enjoy it. It had, what was his name? I want to say David Lynch, but I know that's not right. Richard Lynch? Is that his name? Creepy old guy who does a lot of those type movies. I think it was Chainsaw from Summer School. It was Chainsaw or Dave. I don't remember. But anyway, he's in there. And there's just a lot of neat stuff. And it was one of those with a twist ending that kind of comes out of nowhere, but also kind of makes sense, you could say. But overall, Bad Dreams is a good film. I enjoy it as well. And so there you go. With Dream Warriors... Again, the music video by Dokken, I think it was. It became like one of those MTV, like big videos in rotation, and that kind of helped the movie. And this is also when the movies kind of started to... well, they were doing two things. One, they started to push for a younger demographic, which you're not supposed to do. Kind of caused some problems for them. This is when you saw the era of all the toys and the Halloween costumes and all that kind of stuff start to come out, which got them in a little bit of trouble. But this also kind of started the idea of making the sequels tie into the movies before them. You know, a lot of times the sequels were just supposed to be some sort of similar theme or just the villain returns, but in some different type of story. And this began, well, I don't want to say began, but kind of what Friday the 13th was doing, this is what started it for Nightmare on Elm Street, of really having that idea of the movies before mean something and building from that history. Which, of course, they entirely piss on later on in the series, but we'll worry about that part later. Dream Warriors, it's a fun movie. It's not a good movie, but it's really fun. There's a lot. This is also where they started to do a lot of much bigger special effects. They had more money, so they pushed it bigger, did a lot more in-depth things that were really kind of innovative and fun and neat. And this is also a really good movie if you're just sitting around with your friends and, you know, you're having some beers and whatever. Pop this one in and watch. It's a pretty good time. In 1988, they churned out The Dream Master. This was directed by Rennie Harlan, written by Brian Helgeland, Jim Wheat, and Ken Wheat. And this one followed directly on the heels of the movie before it. So when 3 ended, 4 basically picks up you know, a couple months later. It's almost as if, really, if you look at the movies, 3, 4, and 5 are just kind of one big chapter. Like, they all go together. You can almost make a trilogy just out of those 3 films. In Dream Master, one of the key things is that a girl realizes that her power, she kind of learned this in Dream Warriors, that she could bring other people into her dreams. And in Dream Master, you have this girl, Alice, who's very introverted. She's very... shy, well, I guess that's the same as introverted, very intelligent. She has a lot of daydreams. She's very cute. She has a lot of daydreams, and she realizes that she can start to control the dreams and manipulate the dreams in the same way that Freddy has the ability to take your dream and manipulate it in order to make things terrible. She has the ability to take over the dream and manipulate it and try to make it better. And There's also this kind of minor subplot thing that kind of picks up as you go along, where as the people get killed off, she kind of absorbs their personalities into her and kind of their powers, if you will, so to speak. So, like, her brother is a big kung fu guy. When he bites it, spoiler, sorry, then she actually absorbs his ability to do some kung fu. But only in her dream, you know, not in the real world. In the real world, she can kind of fake it, but it's like when she's in her dream, she can really pull it off and do some kick-ass stuff. And Dream Master was, this one was the first one where you really saw it kind of overproduced for the modern era of horror movies. Like I said, in the earlier movies, when they didn't have as much of a budget, they had a spot. They would just have to use it. They'd have to make it look dank and dirty, and then they'd just bring the cameras in, and that's where they would film. Starting with 4 is when they really start to feel like you're on a soundstage. 3 had a little bit of that, but not as bad as 4 does. In 4, everything is very clean and crisp, and even the stuff that's old and dirty looks like it's something new that they just sprayed with a bunch of gunk to make it look old and dirty. So I think really 4 is almost like the Return of the Jedi. If you think about the Star Wars movies, you had this sense in the earlier Star Wars movies that a lot of the technology is stuff kind of built on stuff and stuff cobbled together with other stuff, and a lot of it's dirty and doesn't work and whatever. And then in Return of the Jedi, it's like everything's clean, everything's precise. And when they're in the forest, everything is, you know, even stuff that's apparently left out in the woods on this planet is all clean and crisp and new and nice and whatever. And that's kind of how Dream Master feels a lot of times. It's spaces don't feel lived in. They feel like sets. And that's kind of a problem, I think, with the tone of the movie. And I don't know if that's necessarily a fault of Rennie Harlan. You know, a lot of people discredit him as a director. They say he's not very good and he lacks a lot of vision. I don't know if that's necessarily his fault, that it doesn't look that way, but it's definitely something he maybe should have noticed and tried to work against. And, you know, I don't know. But Dream Master, again, it's not great, but it's fun. And especially because it follows up on Dream Warriors, it does have that fun sequel-type feel where you are continuing this story that makes it feel a little bit bigger and better. Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5, The Dream Child, directed by Stephen Hopkins and written by Leslie Boehm. This was where the franchise, I don't know if you want to say it was abandoned by a lot of fans, but after the massive success of the last two movies, this one coming along just didn't do as well. You know, people didn't rate it as highly. They didn't think it was as fun. It wasn't as interesting. And this is another one where they started to kind of lose a lot of their creativity. Whereas before, you had these kind of gory death scenes. Like in 3, there's a boy who likes to make puppets. He makes marionettes. He likes to carve them. And so Freddy comes and slits the guy's arms and legs open and pulls out like tendons and veins and whatever, and turns them into puppet strings. So this guy is like kind of being suspended by his own veins and tendons and whatever, and being forced to walk along to his death. When you come to like The Dream Child, the stuff where like this guy's on a motorcycle and the pipes on the motorcycle start to like push themselves up his legs, and he's just like screaming, "Ugh!" while he's driving on the motorcycle. Instead of like stopping the motorcycle, crashing the motorcycle, jumping off the motorcycle, it's just like he tries to keep driving straight even though this stuff is like digging into him. You know, it doesn't make any sense. There's a kid who wants to be a comic book artist, so suddenly the world becomes black and white, like black and white artwork from a comic. Freddy's in black and white, so the guy makes himself into a superhero and has all these guns and is shooting at him. And then Freddy cuts him, and he turns into a paper cutout of himself, and all the color drains out, and he dies. And it just got silly. And I think part of the problem was, originally, when Wes Craven set this up in the original Nightmare on Elm Street. When the people died in these horrific nightmare scenarios, that's how they were found dead. So, for instance, Glenn, who's played by Johnny Depp in the first movie, he gets sucked down into the bed. Freddy reaches up through the bed, pulls him down into the mattress through this hole, and then you just see this gush of blood come out. Then later on, when they reference finding him murdered, there's one of the police officers on the phone, and he's saying, like, the coroner is puking in the other room. There's blood everywhere. It's, you know, it's a whole mess. It's a nightmare. So technically, the way Glenn dies in the dream is how he really died in the real world. It's like his body exploded. Like, everything just flew everywhere. There was blood coating everything. When you get to a movie like The Dream Child, the aforementioned comic book fan who gets cut and the colors drain out of him, when they go to try to find him, shelves of the building that he's living in, these warehouse, they've collapsed and all this heavy stuff has fallen on him. So the heavy stuff falling on him has nothing to do with the nightmare scenario in which he died. But that's how they've put it together. And the problem is that they have that lack of bridging what's happening in the dreams with what's happening in reality. And I think that's part of the reason why it falls apart. Because when you have that original scenario where Freddy comes in, he does something terrible, he slices, he dices, he, you know, whatever, then you know that somebody's been murdered. You know this idea that there's somebody out there killing people. And it's, who do you blame it on? Who are they going to try to frame for it just to say that he's the one so they can, you know, try to, you know, hide it and put it behind them, whatever. And later on, it's accidents. It's, the heavy shells falling on him. A girl chokes, and so she just kind of falls over on the table and chokes and falls over, dies. And I think it lacks some sort of cohesion when they lost that focus. And that, to their credit, they kind of bring that back later on when they do stuff like New Nightmare, Freddy vs. Jason, whatever. But in these, it's just they got too silly, they got too far out there, they lost the focus because they kept trying to want to do something creative, and doing something creative isn't necessarily what's best for storytelling. And I bring that up because the next movie, 1991, Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, from Rachel Talalay, written by Michael DeLuca. Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, this was the 3D movie. This was the movie where they advertised it as being 3D. When you bought your ticket, they gave you 3D glasses. 3D was supposed to be a very big deal when it came to watching this movie. And they needed some way of using that hook of 3D. And instead of just saying, hey, we're making a 3D movie, they wanted to somehow turn 3D into a plot device. So you go through like 3/4 of this movie, and the movie is normal. And suddenly this girl goes into the dream world, and she puts on the glasses, and the glasses kind of merge and sparkle and disappear into her face. And now suddenly the movie's in 3D. And then at the end, they sparkle and kind of come back on her face, and she takes them off, and the movie's no longer 3D. Like, they, instead of just saying, hey, 3D, let's make 3D, they decide that it's got to be a segment. So one, you're expecting 3D to be the entire movie, and it's not. It's just a small part at the end. And two, it's done so sloppily, they take every easy opportunity they can, like someone picks up a baseball bat and of course they hold it out towards the camera, and someone throws something. Oh, I just hit the laptop. Someone throws something and it throws and it, you know, comes at the camera, and they do every cheap 3D trick instead of just using the 3D to kind of explore the space and get away with some of these nightmare scenario things that maybe they couldn't do before. There's really nothing special about that 3D. Like, you would think that if you're making a horror movie and you're going to have 3D, you're going to have this ability of kind of like when they did oh man, what was that horror movie in 3D that came out? My Bloody Valentine. My Bloody Valentine used the 3D in fun, innovative ways, in ways you didn't expect, where the 3D added something to what you were watching. It made the special effect that much more special. Whereas in this, it just made the special effects look cheesy. And the idea was that Freddy had this long-lost daughter. She had escaped and gone to another town. So this boy, who's like the last teenager in Springwood, Freddy somehow implants himself into the boy's brain. The boy escapes Springwood, goes to a new town, and then once he's in that new town and he's around more kids, then Freddy can come back out and start his rampage again. Which, following... like, there was a certain logic, even if you take out Nightmare on Elm Street 2, there's a certain logic to 1, 3, 4, and 5, where they're all part of this chain and everything kind of works together. Once you get to the final nightmare, it's like a lot of those rules and a lot of those things that kind of made sense from before just don't really make sense anymore. It just doesn't work. And this is also one where Freddy was way too funny. He was cracking way too many jokes. He was doing a lot more physical comedy. Boy falls out of the airplane, and so he does like this Bugs Bunny, Wile E. Coyote bit where he's pushing a bed of spikes down on the ground. And then the boy hits the ground and he like bounces through. I don't remember. It was not good. So overall, Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare is not a great film. It's one of my lowest on the totem pole movies. It does have Alice Cooper in it. So if you're a big fan of Alice Cooper, you probably know that already. 1994. This is what brought out Wes Craven's new nightmare. Wes Craven returned as a writer and director. And the idea of this is that he, as the writer, realizes that there's some sort of evil that Freddy is kind of like manifesting. And when he made the movies and put Freddy on the movie screen, it gave that evil energy a place to go. And now that they've stopped making the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, like they made Final Nightmare and that was supposed to kill him off and be the end of it, now that there are no Freddy movies, then that evil no longer has this place to be used on the screen, so it's coming into the real world. And so he brought back a lot of the actors from the original Nightmare on Elm Street, and they had reappeared in Dream Warriors. Brings back Nancy and her dad and some of those people. And in the real world, all these characters are playing themselves. So they appear on TV talk shows, and Robert Englund is in the Freddy get-up and, you know, scaring kids, having fun, blah, 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 whatever. And the funny thing is, a lot of people heralded this movie as this great original idea that, you know, Wes Craven came up with, and how groundbreaking it was that he had this idea of bringing the horror movie character into life like this. And the funny thing is, this almost this exact same plot was done in the 70s in Brazil. There's a guy down there, Jose Mojica Marins, I believe is how you pronounce it. I'm probably pronouncing that way wrong. Makes a series of movies that we translate here in the United States as the Coffin Joe series. He's a gravedigger, undertaker character, and they use Joe because he's like this everyman type character, but he elevates himself because he realizes that blood is eternal, and the only way to make sure that he lives forever, because he doesn't believe in God, he doesn't believe in heaven, he doesn't believe in reincarnation, he doesn't believe in any sort of supernatural along that lines, but he does believe that if he produces a great offspring, then that offspring will continue to rule, you know, take over. Like, he lives in a small town, and he thinks maybe his offspring will be a better person, will be able to control more lives, take over more of the world, whatever. And they did a movie called The Bloody Exorcism of Coffin Joe. Well, at least that's the English version of the title. And in that movie, the writer-director, who's also the star, plays his own character. His character has long fingernails. His character he himself stopped cutting his fingernails and let them grow long in order to stand out and be creepy. So that he has these big kind of like claws on his hands from his fingernails growing long. And when I say long, I mean like 8 inches, 10 inches long, like super long fingernails that he grew legit. And he goes to like the countryside to relax, to get away from the Coffin Joe character, to stop making the movies for a while, because he was churning out these movies in Brazil. You know, he was making some pretty good money. And so the plot was he was trying to get away from it all and stop making the movies. And because he does, Coffin Joe becomes real and starts to turn his friends at this like villa where they live out in the countryside, starts turning them into his cultists, turning them into the Coffin Joe cultists. So the writer-director guy has to travel to hell where he meets his fictional character, who it turns out is really evil, who has been trapped in these movies, who's now able to manifest himself in the real world, and he's got to defeat this long-fingernailed villain before he can take over the real world. And that's Wes Craven's New Nightmare. In many ways, there's so much of this. Now, to the best of my knowledge, no one has ever asked Wes Craven about this, and no concrete evidence exists linking the two together, but it's just so... It's like Quentin Tarantino and the way he rips off so many other movies. Like, Reservoir Dogs is basically the Japanese movie City on Fire. He just gave it cool hipster LA dialogue, but it's exactly the same movie. He just chopped up the order in which you see it. He does a lot of flashbacks, where in that movie it's straightforward, but otherwise he just ripped off City on Fire. I don't know if that's the same deal here with Wes Craven and Wes Craven's New Nightmare, but the connections between Wes Craven's New Nightmare and the bloody exorcism of Coffin Joe, you can't ignore. There's just so much between the two that the idea of it being a coincidence just seems kind of hard to reckon. So, nothing after New Nightmare. I mean, a lot of people kind of liked it, but it didn't really make Freddy likable or cool. He wasn't funny, so you didn't have like the girlfriend factor, you know, willing to go see it, whatever. It didn't do that great at the box office, so we really didn't have anything in New Nightmare for a while. But in 2003, they did Freddy vs. Jason. In the meantime, between Jason Goes to Hell, where they had Jason, where they had Freddy appear at the end, they were trying to make Freddy vs. Jason, and the producers on the Jason side were tired of waiting. They made Jason X, which is not bad, pretty good in many ways. Because of the buzz of that movie and the way it kind of brought everything back up and brought everything back into the limelight, made people go, well, what happened to the thing where they were going to do with Freddy? Talks started happening again. They really started pushing. And so they made Freddy vs. Jason in 2003, directed by Ronnie Yu, written by Damian Shannon and Mark Swift. One of the big problems with this movie is that Sean S. Cunningham was the producer. Sean was also the producer on Jason Goes to Hell. He kind of hated the fact that Friday the 13th became so powerful, became such a big hit, and became such a strong franchise. He always, I don't know if he was embarrassed by it necessarily, but it was something he made just to make money. And it was so much more successful than the real movies that he had been making, he was trying to make, that he actually cared about, that he kept wanting to, I mean, in a sense, destroy his own franchise. Because he really didn't like it. He really seems to resent the fact that that's what he's remembered for. So when they were doing Freddy vs. Jason, he became the producer, and he really, you could really tell that he didn't care about the characters. The Springwood that this Freddy lives in has zero resemblance to any version of Springwood we've seen before in any of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. The Jason that appears in this movie has almost no resemblance to any Jason we've seen before, other than he wears the hockey mask. But pretty much everything else about him is completely different. There's almost no mention of any real link to either of the earlier movies in the franchises, other than the fact that, you know, they, well, 15 years ago, my brother said the blah, 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 blah. But otherwise, it really doesn't connect. There is no real connection between them. And because of that, the movie just feels kind of out of place. Now, the one thing that they did do that I did enjoy is that they went back to the idea where someone in the dream world, they get lost, and Freddy cuts them. And then you see in the real world, they're sitting there, and these cuts appear on them. They start bleeding. It's that idea of how they die in their dream is how they die in the real world. So there's no more of this, Freddy decapitates someone in their dream, and then they just crash their car, you know, and that's how they die. They went back to that idea of having that real connection. So, I mean, on the one hand, I give it credit for that. On the other hand, it had John Ritter's son. I can't remember his name, but I'm sorry. Like, I don't wish the man any sort of real. I don't mean to bring him down that much, but he's not a good actor. And in fact, a lot of the actors that they chose in this movie, it seemed like they just went for as cheap as they could get. It had Kelly Rowland from Destiny's Child. She did a terrible job. Maybe she tried really hard, you know, but it didn't. Freddy vs. Jason just felt more like a movie made for the CW network. It was really overproduced. The look of everything just kind of felt wrong. It had some neat iconic moments where you had the two facing off. They're in the Camp Crystal Lake Lodge that catches on fire, and they're kind of going at each other. And some of that stuff is kind of neat. But it felt more like these were levels in a video game. Like, I'm really surprised they didn't do a Freddy versus Jason fighting game and use some of these levels. Oh, look, it's the boiler room. Oh, now they're on the docks. Oh, now they're in the cabin. You know what I mean? It felt kind of half-baked. They put in a fake Jay character, if you remember Jay and Silent Bob. They put that guy in there, a fake version of him. They couldn't get the real guy. I don't know if Jason Mewes was too stoned to show up that day, so they hired somebody else, or what the deal was. But they made a character that's totally a ripoff of him. But, you know, overall, it failed on so many levels. It was going to deliver so much. And honestly, if they had made that movie in 1987, 88, around the time they were doing Dream Warriors or Dream Master, it probably would have turned out pretty good. But that far along, people just didn't really seem... And when I say people don't really seem to care, I don't mean the fans didn't really seem to care. I mean the producers, the writers. Freddy was a joke. Freddy was an afterthought. So you're going to make a movie, so it's got to be over-the-top funny. It's got to be over-the-top zany. There's no real creepiness factor to it. There's no real blood and gore and all that kind of stuff is gone. Like, there's really nothing of... For a horror fan, there's nothing of value to it. It just... The only thing that makes it cool is that it's Freddy versus Jason. But beyond that, it really just kind of falls apart. So that brings us all the way around to 2010 with the remake of A Nightmare on Elm Street. And for this remake, they got the guy who played Rorschach in Watchmen. I can't think of his name. But basically, now, instead of being Nancy Thompson, he's chasing Nancy Holbrook. Now, they went back to the idea that Freddy was a molester as well as a murderer. So all of these kids had been molested by Freddy, but he didn't get to kill them before the parents were able to chase him down and kill him. So Freddy's trying to get revenge on the kids who turned him in, basically, and hunt them down and kill them. And I guess really the idea is that Freddy wants Nancy to fall into a coma. So basically she'll spend her life stuck in a dream where she's stuck with him and he can kind of torture her forever. I guess until her body actually dies or they Terry Schiavo her and pull the plug. But regardless, it it works on the idea of that revenge. Like, he's willing to kind of destroy himself to lock himself in her mind so that she's forever stuck in the dream and he's forever stuck in there with her so he can torment her and just, you know, all the terrible things he wants to do with her, he does for real. Or not does for real, but does forever. Until they die. And so in that sense, I think it works a little better. And I think it had a better feel. Obviously, they had a lot of money that they put into it. So it had that feel again, like they actually went out to locations that existed and filmed in them, as opposed to building giant sound stages for a lot of the stuff. But there was something wrong in Freddy this time around, in just the way they brought in a different actor instead of Robert Englund, because they wanted, the idea was this, they wanted to kickstart something new. They were hoping that they could re-energize the franchise by having it different. So, Freddy, originally the Robert Englund version of him would kind of switch between kind of that Dream Master kind of demon character. He had a deep voice. He was very menacing and stoic and scary. And then he could snap out of it and be funny and crack jokes and whatever. And the jokes were kind of like a later addition that they brought into it. So when they did the remake, they kind of cut that humor out of him. But they also kind of changed him so that when he appears in the dreams, he's supposed to be more menacing and he's supposed to be scarier. So he does look bigger and beefier than he did before. He has the deep voice. The glove doesn't look like something that he fashioned together himself anymore. It looks like this kind of menacing claw thing to it. And it kind of felt overdone. It kind of felt like they worked too hard to energize the demonic dream version of Freddy. I think it would have worked a little bit better, at least for me and my tastes, if it looked like this was the same guy who had just found like some sort of loophole into immortality, as opposed to this kind of supercharged demon that was coming at him. Because in the end, it's still that same revenge plot. It's not as if he had been like empowered by the Dream Masters to go after the kids because of some ancient prophecy, whatever. But I mean, that's kind of how it feels, by the way that he's superpowered by it. It feels like there's a little too much that they're trying to have go on behind the scenes with him. So it worked on certain levels. It's certainly better than some of the sequels. I enjoyed it enough. I'm kind of nitpicking a little bit. Overall, it was more enjoyable than it was terrible. Kind of like the Friday the 13th remake. Unlike the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, it had more good parts than it had bad parts. But overall, it just felt like it wasn't exactly true to the source material. But considering it was following after Freddy vs. Jason, I think it's all right. It's much closer than that was to the original source material. All right, folks, that is an hour and 20 minutes of show, so I think I'm going to wrap it up. But Merry Christmas, everybody. If you've got any Christmas wishes you want us to pass on, if you got anything good for Christmas or you got something good for somebody else, feel free to drop us a line, let us know. If you have any thoughts about Friday the 13th movies, if you want to complain about Toy of the Year, if you want to say, hey, I saw the new store, it looks cool, then just go ahead and contact us. You can send me an email, dirt@popculturenetwork.com. You can go to the official forums of the Pop Culture Network at jointheforums.com. You can find us on Twitter. I'm on Twitter @PCN_dirt. You can find me on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/VGLosers. We're on Google+. Just look for Pop Culture Network 1. Don't go to Pop Culture Network, because that is some sort of like mistake, shadow page that was made accidentally and now we don't know how to get rid of it. So don't go there. Go to Pop Culture Network 1 on Google+. Or you can call our 24-hour voicemail line. It's area code 217-953-4025. You can leave a voicemail 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, anytime that you want to. Go ahead and call that number. leave a message. And that's going to do it for today. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I know you're going to hate me for picking Masterpiece Soundwave as Toy of the Year, but that's just the way the cookie crumbles. And if you don't like it, make your own podcast. And we'll put it here on Pop Culture Network. Make it sound good. Package it together nicely. Don't use copyrighted music. Send it to us. And maybe we'll find a spot for it on the network. Thanks for listening, guys. I'll talk to you after a while.